This is the BBC.
These are the sounds of electric dreams. Singing the body electric. Making the future now and then. What connects all of those sounds over the century or so of music making we've just distilled? Well, everything we've just heard is dependent on synths, on synthesizers of different kinds. It's made by electronic instruments, from keyboard synths in 1980s pop music to the ethereal wails of the electronically sensual theremin in the 1920s, to the ecstatic whoops and cries of the Anne Martineau in Olivier Messiaen's Tarantella Symphony in the 1940s, or the transcendent beats of Hannah Peel's just-released record Mary Cassio and the Journey to Cassiopeia. We all think we know what synthesizers are. The word conjures up, at least to me, images of new romantic bands in the 1980s and heavily made-up girls and boys or door-faced, shade-wearing keyboardists either pumping out a riff like this, or a bleakly, brilliantly mechanistic march like this. Or dystopian futures sounded in the cinema. Either way, there's probably a keyboard involved, possibly some hair gel, some stylized futuristic visuals to go along with this ultra-aestheticized futuristic sound world. But those classic 80s keyboards are just the tip of the instrumental iceberg of synthesizers. So on today's The Listening Service, what are the secrets of synthesis? How has the idea and its instruments changed music forever? And how do musicians use them across the whole of musical culture? So into the synthetic sonic dream we venture. Behind the instruments themselves, you see, there's the idea of synthesis itself, the fundamental and utopian principle on which all of these instruments are founded. So here's Britain's greatest pioneer and inventor of synthesizers, Peter Zinoviev, on what it's all about.
Think of a sound, now make it.
So that's the ethos of synthesis, simple, from one of the electronic yet flesh-and-blood gurus who are our witnesses on today's The Listening Service. And Zinoviev's idea hints at the sonic possibility that the world of electronics opened up in the post-war era, offering unlimited ideas and feelings and sounds at the touch of a button. Well, actually, at the touch of really quite a few buttons, the twiddling of dozens of Baker-like knobs and the wires, the miles and miles of wiring that you needed back in the 1950s and 60s to take a synthesizer from dream to reality. Well, fine, but what does synthesis really mean and where did it start? Well, time for another of our witnesses, the composer, musician, music box maker and synthesizer freak, one of the stars of this year's Synthfest in Sheffield, Hannah Peel.
If you think back to the 50s, after the war, there was a lot of kind of radio technical bits of things lying around and people were making things out of them.
And one of those heroic inventors was the composer, entrepreneur, son of a Russian prince and a collaborator of Harrison Birtwistle's, Peter Zinoviev, founder of Electronic Music Studios and the maker of the first commercially produced synthesizer that was small enough and relatively user-friendly enough to reach a mass market, the VCS3. More on that historic instrument later. But here's Peter Zinoviev now on the origins of the electronics that allowed him to make his synths.
Yeah, well, basically a synthesizer hasn't changed. There's lots of people making synthesizers now. You have a sound source, which could be an oscillator, which can go high or low, or it could be shh noise. And then you can filter that so that you only hear various frequencies of it. And then you can shape it as an envelope so it can have a fast or short start-up and decay. So it could sound like a bell, or it can start slowly. And then you can add reverberation to it, And then you have to have various controls of doing that. You could have a keyboard which varies the frequency, or you could have a joystick like in the VCS3 which can vary the decay or wherever you plug it in. And then you have other effects, basically. And that's what a synthesizer is.
Okay, so synthesis is the idea of creating and sculpting a sound, determining its physical properties, which means that what you're doing when you're using a synthesizer is being somehow at the sonic coalface, moulding the raw material into something that you imagine, or letting the machine take you places you'd never even dreamt of. Now, we might think of the world of synthesizers as a post-war phenomenon, because we imagine that the technology didn't exist before then. But that's not true, either in the sense of real instrumental precedents for what synths like Peter Zinoviev's would later manage, or the ideas that drove even later synthmeisters. It took the theremin, patented by Leon Theremin in 1928, to give electronic music a physical reality. Sounds are made with a theremin through the apparently telekinetic power of a musician's hands moulding the air itself around an electrically charged wand. Music is magic out of the ether. In the 1930s, there was the Trautonium, wonderful name, a ribbon-based electronic instrument. You slid your finger up and down this ribbon to control pitch and manipulating other sonic parameters with dials underneath. Concertos were composed for this instrument in the 1930s in Germany, including this one by Harold Gentzmer. And Paul Hindemith's concertino for Trautonium and strings. All hail the Trautonium. Now, they're really marvellous and really odd, both of those pieces, I think, because they make these synthetic future sounds of the Trautonium part of a neoclassical soundscape with the orchestras behind them. It's far too polite a music, surely, for this alien invader of the orchestra. It kind of sounds also like an oboe on stimulants, doesn't it? And then there's the Trautonium's cousin, the En Martino, invented in France in 1928. This was beloved of the French composer Olivier Messiaen, whose first piece for the En Martino was for no fewer than six of them. In the setup of the En Martino, you have a keyboard and a metallic ribbon controller, so you can create these vertiginous glissandos up and down the whole range of the electronic spectrum coming out of the speakers. And this is a new, voluptuous sound to which Messiaen gave a mythic power in his Tarangalila symphony. And this is more like it if you're going to put an electronic instrument with an orchestra. Because here the electronics are adding a new dimension to the music, not just replicating what other acoustic instruments could equally have done, like the Trautonium concertos. Mixed with huge orchestra, the En Martino here is the sensual sound of the joy of the blood of the stars in this movement from the Tarangalila Symphony. But there's an even earlier history of electronic instruments. I'm talking about the Telharmonium, a monstrous machine that predates even the theremin, patented in 1897 in New York and developed by Thaddeus Cahill. The Mark I Telharmonium weighed 7 tons, relatively large. The Mark II and III, though, from the first decade of the 20th century, weighed 200 tons and required separate rooms to house their workings, cogs and sonic dynamos, each of which was connected to a separate key at the console. And the unique feature of the Telharmonium was that, thanks to its multiple moving electronic parts, it could synthesise the sounds of acoustic instruments, not just manipulate a single tone. Yet, by 1962, the Telharmoniums were no more. Electronic dinosaurs lost to another era. Now, all of these instruments have sonic glories and big commercial problems. They were hugely expensive to produce, the Ol Martineau still is, and the range of sounds they can actually make is circumscribed by the admittedly beautiful limitations of their technology. And the bigger issue with all of these early electronic pioneers is that they weren't using anything like the full power of synthesis. They're making a tone and manipulating it according to the simplicity of their technology, rather than giving sculptural creative power over the whole realm of new sounds, with the possible exception of the behemothic Telharmonium. But it's that directness of sculptural control that Peter Zinoviev dreamt of in Putney in West London. And that's what he came up with in 1969 with the VCS3. No keyboard, but instead an elegant wooden box that housed a trapezoidally, jauntily angled console and a lot of knobs and controllers. This was the precursor and progenitor of every synth ever made since. Here's Peter Zinoviev.
I formed a company with David Cockrell and Tristram Carey, and we called it EMS. My studio was obviously becoming important, and good people started to work in it, like Bert Wiswell and Henser. And so we formed this team and decided to, first of all, make a product which we could sell to finance the studio, and that was the VCS3. So I designed what the components should be. That was, if only I could have had something like this when I started getting this junk from Lyle Street and other places, and I had this huge, huge studio with thousands of dials, and it was like a terrible laboratory, no space, and it was terrible. If only I could have bought this. And Tristram Carey designed a very nice box with angled, sort of nice wooden, old-fashioned type-looking box. And David Cockrell designed sort of really brilliant hardware for it. One of its features was that you, instead of having leads connecting bits and pieces, you had pins which you put in and that connected them. And that was straight from my great studio, which had a matrix board of hundreds of pins by hundreds of pins. And so a lot of these early ideas were brought in. It's got 3 oscillators, a noise generator, an envelope generator, a joystick which you can assign to any parameter, a ring modulator, and a matrix board which is 16 by 16, and a filter, of course, and then outputs. And it was supposed to be very cheap, but when I think of it, it cost £220.
But you had the most brilliant marketing campaign ever devised for any any instrument ever. I'm thinking in particular of a photograph, Every Nun Needs a Synthy, right?
That was a good one. Started with Every Picnic Needs a Synthy. I mean, I used to go to Scotland a lot, on the west coast of Scotland, and so there were a lot of friends, and we were going on a picnic with great big Demijohn of wine and homemade bread. And so this became a photograph of Every Picnic Needs a Synthy, with me in a kilt playing the synth here. So we had lots and lots, every conductor, every band, every body. We had a coffin, so every body needs a synth here. It's good. One of the best ones, I've still got a pencil. We produced thousands of these pencils, and on it, it says, every note needs a synth here. That was brilliant.
So Zinoviev's idea was to take the synth into the real world of garden parties, convents and all the rest. The story, though, of what happened to EMS is a tragic combination of ambition and disaster in sadly unequal measure. Dreams of a studio on the South Bank in London that would have rivaled the electronic sound-generating engines of creativity like Yannick Xenakis's Semamu and Pierre Boulez's Irkam in Paris Acronyms are essential to electronic music. Or Stockhausen's studio in Cologne, or John Channing's at Stanford. Well, all of that came to nothing when Zinoviev's equipment was flooded out by the Thames. And then there was the March of the Americans. Just after the release of the VCS3 came the Moog, or the Moog. The sound of Robert Moog's Mini Moog, released in 1971, with a keyboard, unlike the VCS3, which made it seem more immediately tactile than Zinoviev's synthy. And the Mini Moog started the trend for synths in pop music. Kraftwerk's Autobahn. The bass line of Michael Jackson's Thriller. Moogs, all of them, multiple mini Moogs in Thriller. In fact, because this instrument is monophonic, can only play one sound at a time, if you want more, you either have to overdub them or simply buy an ensemble of them. Talking of which, Moogs in Space, the Electric Moog Orchestra, playing John Williams' music for Star Wars. But the Mini Moog was just the start. Companies and inventors all over the world took to synth production. And they're not just relics either, these instruments from the late 70s and 80s, because Hannah Peel uses these older synths in everything she does. Her album, Always Awake But Dreaming, is a hymn to memory, and it's also an emotional outpouring as she attempts to communicate with her grandmother, who was afflicted with Alzheimer's. So these synths are tokens of memory, as well as alienated strangeness. And Hannah Peel brought an old synth into our session, a Wasp, made in 1978 and coloured as yellow and black as the angry insects that give this tiny but powerful monophonic synth its name. A two-octave keyboard, or what looks like a keyboard, it's really a kind of sheet of plastic over a ribbon controller. A few dials, some fragile plastic, a compact bit of circuitry, and that was it. It didn't look like much, to be honest, until she plugged it in.
So you can start off with an oscillator. For example, we have one here. And you can add another one into it, so you can then tune it.
So even though it's a monophonic thing, so it reacts to one key, you can, of course, add other tones to it and manipulate them.
Yeah, and
great
you can,
chords,
and they have, and the oscillators have two different waveforms, so... So there you have another one. And then you have frequency controls, so you can take out the low pass filter, or you can add in more of the high frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And then things like this, which I find really amazing. This is a random setting on the control oscillator. And you just get these fabulous kind of things that just come out of nowhere.
I mean, this is already like, feels like half a track that could be, and the layering of the strata of it. But this is just wonderful watching you, because it's just, it's so immediate, the response. You know, in a way that any instrumentalist is the same thing, you know, what you do with your hands, there's a direct reaction.
Yeah.
Just that thing about the difference between the square and the saw and the sine wave. Can you just illustrate that?
Yeah, so... So, if we add a little bit of pitch into it, you can hear it a little bit better. So that mm-hmm. is a sine wave. You have a...
These rolling undulations.
Yeah, and this is the rising triangle, or sawtooth. And the square, which is a little bit more brashier. And you get a noise one, which is basically like white noise, so we can add that in. So effects and things... like taking off, and on, you can use that so you can create snares and things and percussion. And then this one's my favourite, which is the random, which mixes it all up together. And I love this.
Just tell us, when was this made? And what's
so,
its story?
I mean,
there's the odd crack in this one. Not in the sound.
It's very brittle. I mean, the plastic. It was one of the cheapest synthesizers when it was first made. And it
was the end of the 70s, right?
End of the 70s into the early 80s. A company called Electronic Dream Plant, who were based in Oxford. the colour is just the tempting thing, but it was made as one of the cheap synthesizers. So, for example, like Duran Duran's, Nick Rhodes had one, Depeche Mode used them, Eurythmics. So I think it appealed to everybody in that era that couldn't afford, you know, the big Arps and the Moog synthesizers because they were so expensive. But I suppose its cheapness is also its Achilles heel because it is very fragile and easily breakable. And I think a lot of people in the beginning just thought, oh, you just replace it and get another one. So now, because obviously they're out of manufacture, they're very collectible and highly prized, and the price is probably four times as much as what it used to be. So.
And you've got a bit of Depeche Mode.
Yes.
They're using the Wasp on this track, right?
Yes, so they open it up with the track, and it's called Never Let Me Down Again. And give me 2 seconds because I want to get the tempo right.
Depeche Mode's Never Let Me Down Again from Music for the Masses, their 1993 album with Hannah Peel and her Wasp. So synths had journeyed from the laboratory to the marketplace. They'd made it from research facilities like Bell Labs in the US and EMS in the UK to the glitter and glam of pop cultures everywhere. And they began to change in what they offered the player. Where the early synths like Zinoviev's VCS3 were tools for sonic sculpture, later models like the Digital Keyboard Classics, the Korg M1 and the Yamaha DX7 made things much easier for players by pre-programming patches so that you didn't have to create the sounds yourself, you could just use the presets. And it was these sounds, these preset sounds, that defined much of the pop of the late 80s and 90s. But musicians were still experimenting. Frank Zappa in California had a synclavier made by Yamaha. Now, this was a ferociously expensive studio setup which allowed you to control every parameter of the music you made and create massive textures of complexity and density all on your own. If, that is, you knew how to work it. And Frank Zappa certainly did. Here's G-Spot Tornado from his album Jazz from Hell. Music that was so complex it was turned into an orchestral version with Ensemble Moderne, a record conducted by Pierre Boulez. But here, in the synthetic original, I mean, it's like Conlon Nancarrow's player pianos, but more complicated rhythmically and texturally. It predates what George Ligeti would do with his piano etudes. I mean, this is music of absolutely explosive thickness and yet immediacy and the rhythmic punch that Zappa's sounds make here. And on the other side of the Atlantic, in the computer music laboratories of IRCAM in Paris, under the steps of the Pompidou Centre, Pierre Boulez spent decades refining the electronic sounds that mix with the live instruments in his work Réponds, Responses. And these chiming, electronic, bell-like tolls seem to suspend time and space. They exist in a limbo between the real world of the acoustic instruments and the virtual world of the electronics. They have an uncanny physicality, like all of the best noises made by synths. Yet these sounds also have, I think, a quality of uncanny cleanness, purity and shimmering perfection. They glimmer and glint rather than crunch and scream. And by the late 1980s, synthesis had gone digital. And there's a theory that something was lost in the transfer to the pure world of number, of bits and bytes and ones and zeros. Despite the fact that the very same criticism of coldness, of inhumanity, of alienation was made against the older analogue synths too. And from the physicality of machines, keyboards and rooms of equipment, synthesizers are now on screen in software rather than there in physical, touchable hardware. Hannah Peel uses older synths, or tends to, so does she think that we've lost something?
For me, it's the only way to communicate what I hear inside my mind. And I think that from the very early days of when, you know, before even the keyboard was attached to it, I think that's what appealed to a lot of the psychedelic culture and that era of wanting to find something that just wasn't strict. And even now I'm still trying to find that in the instruments. And I suppose the digital age, it comes with all the settings and your software synths are all there. You don't get to play with it as much, whereas you got it in front of you, you can use both hands and you can find these things, and the errors are sometimes the beauty.
Peter Zinoviev said that, you know, the principle of synthesizers is basically think of a sound and you make it happen. That's the ultimate thing that synthesizers have given. Are there sounds that you can't make yet? Are there places that the synthesizer needs to go even further?
Yeah, definitely. I suppose just flexibility in terms of how you play it and how you use it. And I suppose the keyboard is the one thing that you and I go to because I'm a pianist classically, but I'd love ways to be able to play it that isn't necessarily stuck to that one note and, you know, kind of pushing those limits. But I still think there's a lot further places we can go physically.
So we're back to the idea that synthesis is about making all of the sounds you can imagine that don't exist yet, a utopian idea that should still drive musical culture. The irony, though, is that it's the distinctiveness of the instruments that Peter Zinoviev made and that Hannah Peel loves that makes synths what they are. They're phenomena of the past that will always form the future as they're made in new contexts. And that's something you can hear in Hannah Peel's electronic and acoustic Journey to the Stars, her latest album project, Mary Cassio, Journey to Cassiopeia, a vision of an elderly pioneer of electronic music who gazes at the stars from Barnsley and realises her lifelong dream to escape her South Yorkshire home and see Cassiopeia close up. And she takes her local brass band with her, of course. And in this record, as in Boulez's Répond or Zappa's Jazz from Hell, or any of the great songs in which a human voice is there with the synths, with the electronics, here the synthesizers are both a bridge to a new world and the expression of our human dreams of the beyond. And in this piece from Mary Cassio, Sunrise Through the Dusty Nebula, brass band are made to sound as uncanny, as out there as the electronics as warm and fuzzy and human in the feelings they give us as the cornets and the trombones. It's a cliche about science fiction writing that we learn more about the time it was written than any clues as to the shape of things to come. Well, that's true of our relationship with synths too. Synthesizers are visions of the future that are really about our present. We are all stardust, and synths are sonic stardust too.
This is the BBC.